All right. So let's go ahead and get started. Thank you, everyone, for coming to this session of the 2012 Sansone Symposium. And our title today is What Keeps Mormons and Evangelicals from Cooperating Politically? Because we'd all like to know more about how they can cooperate better politically, right? Okay. So we have two presenters today, or we have one presenter and then a respondent. Our presenter is John Charles Duffy. He's a visiting assistant professor in comparative religion at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. He teaches courses on religion in American history and culture. Our respondent is Bridget Jack Jeffries. She's a graduate of Brigham Young University and an MA in American Church History at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. She's a member of the Evangelical Covenant Church and a wife of a believing, practicing Mormon, an actual believing, practicing Mormon. So after they both speak, we will have time for a question and answer session. At that point, I think what we're going to do is have anyone who asks questions actually come up here to the front and speak into the microphone. But so.
This is clearly a pre-laptop era of you.
Is that microphone working?
Yes, I just need to bend into it, unfortunately. Mormons and evangelical Protestants in the United States have natural political affinities. Both groups are known for their conservative social values. Both tend to vote Republican in solid to overwhelming majorities. Nevertheless, there is a widespread perception that political cooperation between Mormons and evangelicals faces a serious impediment, namely the fact that evangelicals don't recognize Mormonism as authentically Christian. We heard that assertion frequently during Mitt Romney's presidential campaigns. Until Romney became the Republicans' presumptive nominee for 2012, the central media narrative about his religion was that evangelicals do not want to vote for a Mormon. In support of that narrative, journalists and pundits pointed to prominent evangelicals who argued that Christians should always vote for Christians, ergo not for a Mormon, or that electing a Mormon president would lead to an increase in the number of people converting to Mormonism and therefore being lured away to hell. Other recent incidents offer additional examples of friction between Mormons and the evangelical right. In 2004, the National Day of Prayer Task Force, an evangelical organization that sponsors annual prayer services across the U.S., barred Mormons from the program of the Utah service. The exclusion prompted the Utah Valley Interfaith Association, on which Mormons are represented, to withdraw its support from the task force's service and to hold their own prayer service instead. In addition, Mormons sent an outpouring of angry emails to LDS Church headquarters over this incident. In 2008, the organization Focus on the Family pulled an interview with Glenn Beck from one of its websites and apologized to its evangelical constituents for having given the impression that Beck was a Christian. Again, Mormons expressed outrage. Despite this litany of offenses, I'm going to argue that evangelicals' theological objections to Mormonism are less of an impediment to political cooperation than these incidents would suggest. In fact, Mormons and evangelicals have collaborated in a number of political or culturally conservative initiatives over the past few decades. They have worked together on state or national campaigns to oppose the Equal Rights Amendment, pornography, gambling, and same-sex marriage, as well as a campaign to support passage of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993. Mormons, Southern Baptists, and Pentecostals worked together as part of an interfaith coalition that in the 1980s founded Odyssey, a faith and values cable television station whose programming included televised LDS sacrament services and church films. During the 1990s, Mormon scholars collaborated with evangelical and Catholic colleagues at the conservative religious journal First Things, as well as at conferences to promote the revitalization of religious higher education. Mormons contribute to international pro-family movements in which American evangelicals also participate, such as the World Congress of Families. And despite 6 years of media coverage suggesting that evangelicals won't support a Mormon president, it now appears that evangelical Republicans are lining up behind Mitt Romney. What makes the difference? Why is there more friction between Mormons and evangelicals in some political settings than in others? Clearly, there is more to be said than simply evangelicals don't want to work with Mormons because they don't think Mormons are Christians. We need a more nuanced explanation. we need to understand under what circumstances or in what ways evangelicals' theological objections to Mormonism become an impediment to political cooperation. My goal today is to provide that nuanced explanation. In a nutshell, my argument is as follows. There is a militant, outspoken minority of evangelicals who oppose political cooperation with Mormons on theological grounds. But these evangelicals are not so important as a political force. Most American evangelicals, including the leaders of the evangelical right, are open to collaborating politically with Mormons. There's a catch, however. Even evangelicals who are willing to work with Mormons want to avoid giving the impression that they accept Mormonism as authentically Christian. This is because evangelicals are concerned about safeguarding the theological boundaries that define their movement. That concern affects not only evangelicals' relationship with Mormons, it also sets the terms under which evangelicals can collaborate politically with other religious groups, notably Catholics. Because of evangelicals' scruples about theological boundaries, Mormons and evangelicals are best able to work together in citizens' coalitions that don't claim a religious identity, or in interfaith coalitions that are broad enough to include non-Christians. If Mormons try to participate in organizations that specifically identify as Christian, or if they deploy rhetoric about Christian values, evangelicals are likely to feel pressured to shore up their theological boundaries by disputing Mormonism's Christian claim and in the process alienating Mormons. There are two reasons why I think it's important to understand the situation in this nuanced way. First, it explains why Mormon evangelical political cooperation succeeds in some situations but not others. Second, and of broader relevance, this more nuanced understanding corrects a misperception of the American evangelical right, who are less averse to religious pluralism than they are often thought to be. So let's unpack that argument, beginning with some history. In the 1970s, conservative evangelicals mobilized into political action groups that came to be known collectively as the New Christian Right. Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority was the most prominent example. From its inception, there was tension within and around the New Christian Right over the propriety of evangelical organizations working with non-evangelicals. Leaders like Falwell recognized the wisdom of forging alliances with other social conservatives across religious lines. But the New Christian Right drew much of its constituency from self-identified fundamentalists, the more militant wing of the broader evangelical movement. Fundamentalists looked very suspiciously at ecumenical initiatives because they believed Christians should not be yoked with unbelievers. One prominent fundamentalist, Bob Jones Jr., accused Jerry Falwell of advancing the work of the Antichrist because of his efforts to bring evangelicals, mainline Protestants, Catholics, Mormons, and Jews under the same banner. By the 1990s, Moral Majority had declined, and a new generation of evangelical political organizations emerged. These organizations, which I will call the evangelical right, were politically savvier and more effective than the early New Christian Right movements had been. Among the things they did better was reaching out beyond a fundamentalist base to a wider segment of evangelicals, as well as to conservative Catholics. This was a period when the term culture war became common to describe the perception that issues like abortion and gay rights were dividing Americans along a conservative-liberal fault line that cut across different religious traditions. Conservative Protestants versus liberal Protestants, conservative Catholics versus liberal Catholics, and so on. This is to say that social conservatives in different religious traditions, increasingly saw one another as natural political allies. However, interreligious collaboration remained problematic for the evangelical right if it seemed to blur theological boundaries. An example of this is the controversy surrounding Evangelicals and Catholics Together, ECT, a 1994 manifesto published over the signatures of a who's who of American evangelical and Catholic conservatives. ECT laid out a conservative political agenda: pro-life, pro-traditional morality, pro-free market capitalism, anti-secularism, framed as a call to arms against all that opposes Christ and his cause. In linking this politics to a shared Christian commitment, the document recognized evangelicals and Catholics as brothers and sisters in Christ. Although the document also listed a number of theological issues that continue to divide the two faiths. Despite that qualifier, ECT was fiercely opposed by some prominent evangelicals who objected to the document's recognizing Catholics as brothers and sisters in Christ. These critics, some of whom it's worth mentioning were also major distributors of anti-Mormon literature, these critics insisted that evangelicals could not recognize Catholics as brothers and sisters in Christ because the Catholic Church taught a false theology of salvation. Some of the critics professed to be open to the possibility of political cooperation with Catholics as long as claims about theological agreement were kept off the table. Other critics, however, revealed themselves to be politically indifferent, meaning that saving souls through the preaching of the gospel in its purity was more important for them than spending time trying to forge political alliances. Evangelical critics of ECT were able to exert enough pressure that some evangelical signatories of the document issued clarifying statements or entirely revoked their endorsement of the initiative. Now, ECT had been a political alliance based on professing a shared Christian commitment. A year after ECT was released, one of its signatories, a Calvinist-turned-Catholic named Peter Kreeft, promoted an even broader interfaith coalition. Kreeft called for conservative evangelicals, Catholics, Eastern Orthodox, Jews, and Muslims to join forces in what he called an ecumenical jihad, a war of all religions against none. By this, Kreeft meant that he wanted adherents of these different monotheistic religions to cooperate in political initiatives to resist secularism and the sexual revolution. I have not seen evangelicals criticize Kreeft's call to ecumenical jihad in the same way they criticized ECT, but it is evident that Kreeft hoped to preempt the kinds of concerns about theological boundaries that had motivated evangelical opposition to ECT. Although he used the word ecumenical, which is a red flag for fundamentalists, Kreeft insisted that he did not subscribe to liberal notions about all religions leading to the same place. He recognized that the faiths he was urging to collaborate had irreconcilable theological differences. The alliance he had in mind was purely tactical, his word, and did not involve doctrinal compromise, again his word. Those disclaimers spoke to concerns shared by theological conservatives in all of the traditions he was speaking to, but especially by evangelicals. In the controversies around the Moral Majority and ECT, and in Kreeft's disclaimers around ecumenical jihad, we see patterns that are relevant to understanding friction around Mormon evangelical collaborations. First, we see that there is a subset of evangelicals who have a militant attitude toward other faiths, and therefore oppose collaborations that seem to them to blur theological boundaries, as ECT seemed to them to do when it recognized Catholics as Christians. Some of these evangelical militants are politically indifferent, meaning that they are much less concerned about politics than about saving souls. Second, we see that even religious conservatives who advocate interreligious collaboration are concerned to show that they are not blurring theological boundaries. Hence, ECT made a point of listing theological differences that still divided Catholics and evangelicals. Hence, Kreeft insisted that he was not advocating doctrinal compromise. Advocates of interreligious cooperation thus share with their critics a certain anxiety about the possibility that political cooperation could lead to theological compromise. They differ with their critics over whether or not theological boundaries have been blurred in specific instances, like ECT. Evangelicals who think that a boundary has been breached will oppose a political alliance. Conversely, evangelicals who favor a political alliance have to be assured that a boundary has not been breached. Okay, I'm going to kind of talk very quickly through the next part of my paper in the interest of time. But in this next section, I identify two reasons why I think theological boundaries are so important to evangelicals, more so actually than they are to Mormons or Catholics. Mormons or Catholics are not quite as anxious about this boundary blurring as evangelicals are. And my two reasons are as follows. First of all, many of the people that today we call evangelicals are either Protestant fundamentalists or have fundamentalist roots, which means they come from traditions that are deeply, deeply anti-ecumenical. Interfaith is for them a four-letter word, and so they're very, very anxious about that. A second reason, though, is that evangelicals are concerned about theological boundaries because theological boundaries are all they have. Evangelical is a very broad label. It is not a denominational identity. It covers rather theological conservatives in various churches. So being an evangelical does not mean that you belong to any one church. So what we call evangelicalism is actually a coalition of people from lots of different churches. What defines them is not institutional boundaries. What defines them are theological boundaries. So what that means is when Mormons or Catholics cooperate politically with people of other faiths, it's very clear to them that they're working with people of other faiths because those people are in other churches, right? The institutional boundary is quite clear. For evangelicals, it can be a more ambiguous experience, because evangelicals are already a group of people from lots of different churches. So when you start adding Mormons or Catholics to the mix, what exactly is happening? Are we saying, okay, we recognize Mormons and Catholics as now evangelicals, they're part of our theological coalition, or is this strictly a political coalition? And so evangelicals may feel more pressure than Mormons or Catholics do to clarify that difference, because the difference isn't so obvious to them, given their lack of institutional boundaries. All right. So recognizing this evangelical anxiety about theological boundaries is the key to understanding why Mormons and evangelicals have been able to cooperate politically in some situations without the friction evident in other situations. When we look at situations where friction was avoided, we can see that they fall into one of two categories. First, Mormons and evangelicals have cooperated in coalitions whose members identified themselves simply as concerned citizens, without organizing around a shared religious identity. Mormons and evangelicals cooperated on this basis in citizens' coalitions opposing the Equal Rights Amendment. This is also the same basis on which they cooperated with evangelicals in supporting Prop 8. Second category. Mormons and evangelicals have cooperated in interfaith coalitions that were defined broadly enough to include non-Christians, people that evangelicals and Mormons would both agree are non-Christians. I mentioned several examples of this type of coalition at the beginning of this paper, the coalitions opposing pornography, gambling, or supporting the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the formation of the Faith and Values cable station Odyssey, collaboration at the conservative journal First Things, or at conferences on religious higher education, and the international pro-family movements like the World Congress of Families, which brings together Mormons, evangelicals, Catholics, Jews, and Muslims. In those two situations, citizens' coalitions and very broad interfaith coalitions, friction between Mormons and evangelicals is avoided because, I'm suggesting, evangelicals did not feel that they were being pressured to recognize Mormons as Christians. Neither of those two kinds of collaborations, in other words, threatened evangelicals' theological boundaries. To that same end, Southern Baptist lobbyist and political commentator Richard Land has proposed in recent years that Mormons be recognized as a fourth Abrahamic faith. By designating Mormonism an Abrahamic faith, Land provides a basis for bringing Mormons into an ecumenical jihad-style coalition alongside Jews, Christians, Muslims. But by designating Mormonism a fourth Abrahamic faith, Land keeps Mormons out of the category Christian, and thus preserves evangelical boundaries and avoids friction, at least from the evangelical side of the equation. Whether Mormons are happy with that exclusion is an entirely different story. I cited earlier some recent cases where there was friction between Mormons and the evangelical right. The exclusion by the National Day of Prayer Task Force of Mormons from their prayer services in 2004, the pulling of the Glenn Beck interview from Focus on the Family's website in 2008, and Mitt Romney's presidential campaigns. In each of those cases, evangelicals were responding to a perceived breach of theological boundaries. In other words, the circumstances of those collaborations were such that evangelicals feared they would be perceived as granting Christian status to Mormons. Consider the flap over the National Day of Prayer Task Force. The National Day of Prayer is an annual observance designated by Congress during the 1950s. The National Day of Prayer Task Force is not a government-affiliated organization. It's an evangelical right group founded in the 1980s to promote the National Day of Prayer and to preserve America's Christian heritage. That's their mission. The organization expects that prayer services conducted under its auspices will reflect a Judeo-Christian orientation, and on that basis it has excluded Hindus, for example, from taking part in its programs. Prior to 2004, Mormons had participated in National Day of Prayer services organized in Utah County in the name of the task force by a member of the Utah Valley Interfaith Association who had volunteered to become a local coordinator for the task force, not realizing it was an evangelical right organization. In 2004, the task force's Utah State coordinator instructed this volunteer that Mormons should not take leading roles in the upcoming prayer service she was organizing. A national spokesman for the task force later defended this exclusion by citing the Lausanne Covenant, which is an evangelical creed written in the 1970s, as the organization's doctrinal standard. Mormons who commented on this incident to reporters expressed outrage at what they saw as an effort by evangelicals to exclude them from a civic event. Evangelicals who commented to the media framed the situation very differently, For them, the task force's prayer services were not civic events. They were evangelical events. They therefore perceived Mormon participation in those events as an encroachment. It was as an attempt by Mormons to assert an authentically Christian identity, which evangelicals were not willing to grant them. Now, this is not to say that the task force's evangelical leadership would not have welcomed collaboration between Mormons and evangelicals in some other context. In fact, an interesting irony in this incident is that the task force's Utah State coordinator, the one who enforced the No Mormons rule, was Baptist pastor Greg Johnson, a leading figure in the Mormon evangelical dialogues that were occurring around that same time in Utah. Johnson clearly welcomes warmer relations between Mormons and evangelicals. At the same time, he insists on recognizing the theological differences that he believes still keep Mormonism from being authentically Christian. The 2008 incident, in which Focus on the Family pulled the Glenn Beck interview from its website, presents interesting parallels to the controversy over ECT, the 1994 Evangelical Catholic manifesto I mentioned earlier. The controversial Focus on the Family interview was a puff piece in which Beck promoted his book, The Christmas Sweater, as a message about Christ's atonement. A small evangelical ministry called Underground Apologetics used the internet to launch a well-publicized complaint that the interview had given the impression Beck was Christian. In response, Focus on the Family took down the interview and explained in an official statement that we do recognize the deep theological difference between evangelical theology and Mormon theology, and that they were removing the interview to avoid confusion. Now, in the ECT controversy, we saw that some evangelicals who had been willing to sign a statement acknowledging Catholics as Christians backed down when they were criticized by evangelicals of a more militant stripe. Similarly, Focus on the Family staff had evidently been comfortable publishing an interview in which Glenn Beck promoted Christian faith, but they backed down from that decision in response to criticism from more militant evangelicals. Like some of the evangelical critics of ECT, the evangelicals at Underground Apologetics were politically indifferent. In their complaint about the interview, they insisted that if Christians really wanted to solve social problems, they should focus on evangelism, not on forging interreligious culture war alliances that, as the Underground Apologetics folks saw it, risked doctrinal compromise. Focus on the Family, being more pragmatic, was interested in building bridges with social conservatives of other faiths, but they were also concerned about maintaining theological boundaries, and that latter mandate is what drove the decision to pull the Beck interview. Mitt Romney's presidential campaigns are an instructive case in how Mormons can effectively manage evangelicals' anxieties about theological boundaries. Romney's Mormonism was a problem for two different groups of evangelicals for two different reasons. First, some evangelicals opposed a Mormon president because they were committed to a partisan Christian politics. Christians should only vote for Christians. Or because they thought that any political gains from supporting Romney were far outweighed by the eternal dangers of increasing Mormonism's social legitimacy. In other words, a Mormon president would make Mormonism more attractive, it would draw converts, their souls would be lost. Now, evangelicals of this type won considerable airtime during the presidential campaigns. However, polls indicate that a minority of evangelicals shared those outlooks. Most evangelicals said they were willing to vote for a Mormon president if, and here's the second reason that Romney's Mormonism was problematic, if they were assured that theological boundaries remained intact. In other words, they needed to be assured that a vote for Romney would not be mistaken as an endorsement of Mormonism's Christian claim. Consequently, even evangelicals who endorsed Romney, like the organization Evangelicals for Mitt, or prominent fundamentalist Bob Jones III, made a point of voicing their opposition to Mormon theology, in Jones' case, very emphatically. Romney misunderstood the situation. He made a strategic blunder at the beginning of his 2008 campaign. He seemed to think that he needed to convince evangelicals he was a Christian if he wanted to win their votes. Hence, he would talk about Jesus as his personal savior. He would talk about how much he loved the Bible without mentioning any other scriptures. This was a mistake. By trying to spin himself as an evangelical-type Christian, Romney prompted the militant evangelical minority to become even more vociferous in exposing Mormon deception. As for those evangelicals who were open to voting for a Mormon, Romney's "I'm a regular Christian" rhetoric made it harder for them to support him, because he was blurring the theological boundary that they needed to have crystal clear. Evangelicals like Richard Lamb, the guy who promoted the fourth Abrahamic faith idea, warned Romney of his mistake, And by the time he gave his televised faith speech on the eve of the 2008 primaries, he seemed to have gotten the message. In that speech, Romney insisted that he considered himself a Christian. But he also acknowledged that my church's beliefs about Christ differ from those of other faiths. That was the disclaimer evangelicals needed to hear. This shift in strategy was not enough to save Romney's campaign. Evangelicals still harbored doubts about his reliability as a social conservative. But it did neutralize evangelicals' boundary maintenance concerns, as well as Romney would hope to do. In 2012, Romney took to describing his faith as Judeo-Christian, an interesting step back from the problematic Christian label. When he gave the commencement address at Jerry Falwell's Liberty University in May of this year, he managed to give an entire speech extolling Christian values without ever actually identifying himself as a Christian. The effect, although subtle, was not lost on his audience. The provost of a Baptist college commended Romney afterward for not pretending to agree with the theology of the Liberty University audience. In other words, Romney had learned to skirt evangelicals' theological boundaries, and that is what has made it possible for conservative evangelicals to line up behind him now that he is a Republican candidate. I would like to draw two morals from this analysis. First, the fact that evangelicals refuse to acknowledge Mormonism as authentically Christian does not mean that Mormons and evangelicals cannot cooperate politically. There is a militant minority of evangelicals who oppose political cooperation with Mormons. But precisely because that minority tends to be politically indifferent, their political influence is negligible. Although I would add here that it does remain to be seen whether that kind of minority, if they will sit out the 2012 presidential election, and whether their numbers, even though they're a minority, might be big enough to make a difference in a close race. We have to see that. But they're not a very big force. That's the important thing to drive home here. Most evangelicals are willing to cooperate politically with Mormons, as long as they don't feel that they're being pressured to accept Mormons as Christians. This means that if Mormons want to collaborate with evangelicals, they should not try to do so under a Christian banner. Instead, they should collaborate simply as citizens or in interfaith coalitions that include non-Christians. An irony here is that some Mormon conservatives have bought into the kind of Christian America rhetoric that characterizes some elements of the evangelical right, which Mormons might think would make them natural political allies. But in fact, Mormons who use that kind of rhetoric are likely to trigger evangelical protests that Mormons can't support Christian values because Mormons aren't really Christians. Thus, what could be a point of convergence is actually going to become a source of friction. Mormons who want to collaborate with evangelicals will have to reconcile themselves to the reality that their evangelical partners may feel a need to periodically announce the fact that they don't regard Mormons as Christians in order to justify the collaboration to other evangelicals. Those announcements don't necessarily mean that evangelicals are refusing to work with Mormons, though again, there is that minority for whom that is the case. On the contrary, announcing that they don't think Mormons are Christian is what allows evangelicals to work with Mormons. My second moral, and with this I'll leave you, is a broader point about the evangelical right and religious pluralism in contemporary American society. The evangelical right is often perceived as promoting a vision of Christian America that would exclude or subordinate non-Christians. While that is certainly true for some in the evangelical right, and while religious pluralism is certainly a subject about which evangelicals are ambivalent, there's an important lesson here. The fact that evangelicals are willing to cooperate politically with Mormons, even though they don't think Mormons are Christians, shows that the evangelical right's politics are not as restrictively Christian as they are often perceived to be. As conservative evangelicals work out the terms under which they can collaborate with Mormons, they are also working out a careful accommodation to pluralistic norms. For observers who are interested in promoting religious pluralism in America, this is perhaps a good thing. On the other hand, if your politics are not conservative, the prospects of Mormon evangelical cooperation may give you other reasons to be concerned.
This was definitely made before computers came around.
All right. I just want to say that I really liked reading John Charles' paper. I was very impressed by his understanding of the workings of the evangelical movement. I know firsthand from my struggles to study Mormonism that it can be very difficult to understand members of a religion that you've never belonged to. It can be very difficult to understand how they think and to deepen your understanding of them. So I just wanted to compliment John Charles on his capacity for this. I also want to say that as I was reading this paper, maybe you as you were listening to it, I never got the impression that he was looking down on or condescending to any of the religious or political groups that he discussed. He was able to discuss their theological and political concerns respectfully and very accurately. I think these are very admirable qualities for any religious historian to have, and I just wanted to commend him for that. I am a Republican. This wasn't in my introduction. I am a Republican and a supporter of Mitt Romney. I know there's like none of us at Sunstone.
Mormon or
otherwise. And I am an evangelical Christian, and I very much agree with his overall thesis. I think it is absolutely true that evangelicals are willing to cooperate politically with members of what they perceive as, quote, non-Christian faiths, just so long as they are reassured that their cooperation is not being seen as an endorsement of those faiths. I had some other examples in mind that John didn't... John, can I call you John, or do I say John Charles?
I remember Charles.
Okay, John Charles. I'm going to keep saying that. Sorry, I just met him this week. John Charles says in his paper... I wanted to bring up some examples, though. In November of 2009, there was a group of Christian leaders which released a document known as the Manhattan Declaration. This document was signed by evangelical Christian, Orthodox, and Catholic leaders, and it talked about advocating for conservative social positions on abortion and birth control. It advocated for conservative positions on gay marriage, and it advocated for perceived issues with religious liberty stemming from gay marriage debate, particularly like religious adoption agencies possibly being forced to adopt out to gay couples. So this document was signed by evangelical, Orthodox, and Catholic leaders, and it repeatedly referred to their Christian heritage, and it cited from the Bible. But you'll notice that no Mormons were invited to sign that document. So there's an example of Christians working with other groups that they accept as Christians, this interfaith collaboration in that sense. There was another document that came out this year in January. It was called, that last document, in case you want to look it up, is called the Manhattan Declaration. This document that came out in January was called An Open Letter on Marriage and Religious Freedom, and it was drafted by a coalition of religious leaders. And this letter included signatories from Jewish, Catholic, Orthodox, Protestant, and yes, Mormon faiths. It was signed by Presiding Bishop David H. Burton. So if John's ever going to publish this paper, those might be good references for the case that they won't work with Mormons if it's just, you know, seen as a Christian cooperation. But if it's seen as a wider interfaith cooperation that includes obvious non-Christian groups like Jews, then they will be more willing to work with Mormons. And that document didn't say anything about the Bible or being Christians or anything. It just came from a general position of religious concern over religious liberty. I really enjoyed his point about boundary maintenance. It's very much true that evangelicals lack a central authority that can declare which groups are authentically evangelical and which groups are heretics. Our boundary maintenance pretty much occurs from the ground up. I should say that often and those boundaries are often policed by lay people via books and other publications. By the way, I often have people ask me, why do evangelicals write books about Mormons and other religions when Mormons don't write books about, you know, Mormons don't write books targeting evangelicals? And this is the answer to that question. Well, they generally don't. There's a couple of examples. This is the answer to that question. Sorry, I lost my place. Mormons don't write books about condemning evangelicals because they don't have to. The First Vision and other institutionalized teachings already assure Mormons that evangelicals and other faiths do not represent authentic Christianity as Jesus taught it. But if evangelicals believe that, if there's another movement out there that evangelicals think does not represent authentic Christianity, they have to spread the word from the ground up and police that themselves. They don't have a centralized document that they can refer to that will say, you know, Mormonism is an abomination in the eyes of God, whatever. The LDS Church, that said, there may be some examples worth mentioning that sometimes having a centralized authority doesn't quite cut it. For example, the LDS Church, as of late, has been going out of its way to notify the press that fundamentalist LDS groups are not Mormons.
It very much parallels how Christians are often arguing that Mormons are not Christians. I think that this is for similar reasons. Basically, fundamentalist Mormon groups are engaging in behavior and activities that Mormons are not comfortable and Mormons don't want to be affiliated with, just as Mormons are teaching things that Christians don't want to be affiliated with. So if we ever here in Utah saw like a fundamentalist Mormon running for an office, you might see some of those similar tensions with people trying to police boundaries if that ever did happen. This generally hasn't been a problem for the LDS Church, though, because fundamentalist groups are so tiny and seldom are out in the public very much. I have a minor quibble with one page where John Charles says that the method of determining evangelicalism's theological boundaries isn't settled, which is true, but it's a quibble. And he suggests sola fide, biblical inerrancy, or adherence to the historic creeds are commonly invoked touchstones. I would actually say that the most commonly evoked parameters of what evangelicalism is that I read in my my books and stuff at Trinity is it's a four-point thing. It's a need for personal conversion. Well, okay. A movement that is evangelical will display these 4 points. A need for personal conversion, what's called a high view of the Bible or biblical authority, which would include inerrancy but goes beyond that. Christocentrism, or an emphasis on the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, and an emphasis on the need for evangelism. To illustrate here, like with biblical authority, you might be thinking, oh, but the LDS Church passes all those. No, they don't. They don't pass the biblical authority test because they definitely have authorities higher than the Bible, which they appeal to. And that's the same for the Catholic and the Orthodox Church. Well, maybe not higher than the Bible, but they have authorities which interpret the Bible, which they can appeal to. The Orthodox and the Catholic Churches do believe in inerrancy, but the Bible is not the ultimate authority for them. The LDS Church sometimes believes in the inerrancy of the original manuscripts, but doesn't believe in the inerrancy of the received text, basically. And we'll sometimes say that the text is mistranslated in places. So the LDS Church doesn't have a high view of biblical authority and wouldn't qualify as evangelical. I believe it was David Bevington who originated this four-point paradigm here. He said, together they form a quadrilateral of priorities that are the basis of evangelicalism. I thought it would be worth mentioning in the paper, I would add this, is that there was a recent survey about desire to vote for a Mormon candidate that Gallup released. And what Gallup actually found was that 80% of Republicans and 79% of independents were willing to vote for a Mormon candidate versus 71% of Democrats. Conversely, 18% of Republicans, 19% of independents, and 27% of Democrats said they were unwilling to vote for a Mormon candidate. So there's been a lot of talk about evangelicals being unwilling to vote for a Mormon candidate, but there's some evidence that Democrats and people who are not part of the religious right are even less willing to vote for Mormonism. And I only bring for Mormon candidates, and I only bring that up because I think that there are issues, reasons why people dislike Mormons and Mormon candidates that transcend concern for theological boundaries. This was mentioned a little bit in American Grace by David Campbell and Robert D. Putnam, that Mormons are the third most disliked religious group in America after Muslims and Buddhists. So there is dislike for Mormonism that kind of transcends evangelicalism's own unique concerns, and that might be worth exploring in the paper or mentioning in the paper. That's pretty much what I wanted to say. I liked the paper. I thought it was a really good paper. I don't know how much time we have left, but I think we can open things up for questions now. So. We've got about 20 minutes, so ask us lots of questions.
Why don't people like the Buddhists?
What's wrong with you Buddhists?
Yeah, what's wrong with
Buddhists?
Yeah.
That's our question.
Okay, come on.
Are you sure Scientologists were in their tombs?
I didn't see it mentioned, but I think that this was talked about on the blog. It's probably just because they don't know Buddhists and they don't know a lot about Buddhists, so they just think they dislike it. I don't know. That's what I saw suggested. Yeah. I actually thought atheists and agnostics would be higher on the dislike list. Not because I don't like them. Anyways.
I enjoyed both of your presentations. But I'd just like to give a third alternative. I'm a Lutheran pastor. I don't think religions ought to cooperate in politics on anything. Yeah. And it's simply because Luther, 500 years ago, taught, and I think correctly, that there should be a separation between church and state, and that has nothing to do with us being Christian, that all the politics. I'm a Democrat. And there are a lot of different ideas about how you can accomplish the same goal. I'm against abortion, as I think probably we all are. But you can either try to get rid of all sex education as a way to try to address that, or to try to get justices on the Supreme Court that are going to have a strict interpretation of the Constitution or something as a way to address that, or you can try to help poor people as a way to try to encourage people to not have as much need for an abortion, because as Jimmy Carter says in our endangered values, that the number one cause of abortion is poverty. So there are a lot of ways politically to accomplish the same end, as far as moral values. And I don't think in our church that we ever have any kind of political test for membership. We have Republicans and we have Democrats and we have Green Party and we have all kinds of people, though probably most Lutherans are Republican and I represent a minority. So I just advocate that let's just leave politics out of religion altogether. As for people as Christians or not regarding people as Christians or whatever, it would seem that the most honest thing that we can do together is to accept that the differences between us are real. Going back to Joseph Smith, History Chapter 1 and the Pearl of Great Price, and our creeds being an abomination and our professors being corrupt, it would seem that the whole foundation of the Mormon religion would be that we really, really disagree. I have Mormon friends, we've been good, close friends, and we can agree to disagree on those topics, and I think that's healthy.
Except it's not even really so much a question as, well, no, it is a question, but it's kind of an open-ended query. And maybe this was discussed earlier, and I missed it at some point.
While you were talking.
But, what's that?
While you were talking.
While I was talking, yeah. This happens. There is a lot of talk about various documents, like the Manhattan Declaration, and organizations amongst evangelicals and other religious groups, and the way sometimes Mormons are invited in there and sometimes Mormons are not. I'd like to know, are there any evangelical authors or organizations, or really if you are aware, either of you are aware of any non-Mormon Christian organizations or authors that have taken a look at Mormon documents and said, oh, this is interesting, this is good, we'd like to be part of this, or, there are some things we agree with this or things we not agree with this. Like, is there any kind of evangelical commentary out there on the proclamation on the family, which is, perhaps the defining LDS document that has guided a lot of the ways in which Mormons have talked about gender and so forth? I mean, if I was wondering if either of you have ever heard of that, or if you could, ever imagine that kind of commentary taking place, of things going the other way, of, evangelicals or others in the Christian world looking at Mormons and wanting to say, okay, here's some things coming out of the Mormon church that, we'd be interested in commenting on or being part of or responding to in one way or another.
Let me say this, because you probably actually have more to say about this than I do, so let me add my little piece to that. That's an interesting question, and my answer is that no, I'm not aware of that, and I think it has to do with the fact that Mormons are the little minority, and so no one really pays much attention to them. There is a very interesting phenomenon where some evangelical thinkers seem increasingly attracted to things going on in Catholic theology, ideas of Catholic natural law, for example, as a basis for making political arguments. So I certainly see that happening, evangelicals looking to Catholics. Evangelicals looking to Mormons, no, and my hunch would be probably because evangelical thinkers don't take Mormon thinkers that seriously. And part of my basis for saying that is that during the 2008 presidential campaign, Richard Mao, the president of Fuller Theological Seminary, a major player in Mormon evangelical dialogue, wrote a couple editorials where he said that he was volunteering to help Mormons think through the difficult theological questions of how to engage in the public square as a religion. I found it, as a Mormon, quite condescending. When I had to write about this for my dissertation, it was really hard to not be angry about it. But if even Richard Mao, who is so sympathetic, is still sort of that dismissive of Mormon thought. My hunch is probably not a lot of evangelicals are looking at Mormon thinking. But do you have any comments on
that? Well, I know that there's been a number of dialogues over the year that have taken place between evangelicals and Mormons, and evangelicals have commented on Mormonism in that capacity. There was the book Mormonism and Dialogue with Contemporary Christian Theology, which was edited by David L. Paulson and Donald W. Musser, I don't know how you pronounce his name, but that was mostly more mainline Protestant dialogue with Mormons, but there was one chapter between David L. Paulson and, the open theist guy who just died, Clark H. Pinnock. There was one chapter on that. There have been several dialogue books, of course, How Wide the Divide, Bridging the Divide, which had Greg Johnson, who he mentioned in his paper, with Robert Millett, and then there was Claiming Christ by, what was his name? Sorry.
Gerald
McDermott, yes, and Robert L. Millett. Yes, you guys have got it. But I haven't seen a lot of evangelicals just looking at Mormon documents for Mormon documents' sake. There was a series of essays that were put out in one of the 2005 Baptist journals, which included Frank Beckwith, and who else? Carl Mosher did an essay for that. It was the whole journal was dedicated to response to Mormon thought. And then, of course, there was the book that they put out a few years ago, The New Mormon Challenge. But beyond that, I can't think of a lot of evangelical thinkers off my head who are engaging Mormonism. Like John Charles said, a lot of them just aren't paying attention to Mormonism, and some of them it's because they don't take it seriously. Some of them, I think it's because they're worried that everybody who engages Mormonism was getting a whole essay in the Farmers Review, engaging whatever their comments are. You see, Mormonism is just a side issue to us. And it's other people paying attention to Mormons is a big deal to you. So Mormons have a lot more time to respond to and engage us when we engage Mormonism, if that makes sense. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, the book you're describing, it's still mostly theology rather than, say, political theology.
Yeah, definitely. I think that I've seen sometimes, this may be a little related, I've seen sometimes that people on Facebook and Christian websites, if they start to circulate something that was authored by a Mormon that they liked without knowing it was authored by a Mormon, later on someone will point out, you know this was written by a Mormon, right? And then some people start saying it's icky poo. I think that's kind of silly, It's like if you liked Marky Mark, what was their name, those lip syncer guys?
Billy
Vanilli, yeah. If you liked their music and then you found out that they were lip syncers, who cares? You liked the music. Why would you quit just because you found out who it was from? That's how I feel.
Great analogy.
Okay, full disclaimer, I am a Mormon, raised Mormon Democrat. Okay. My question for you, let's set the theological sticking points between Mormons and evangelicals aside for just a minute. My question for both of you is, what do Mormons and evangelicals have in common besides what seems to me a shared loathing for the president?
I don't think that's true. I'll rise to the provocation. No, I think there are a number of issues on which Mormons and evangelicals are natural political partners. Antipathy to abortion, although the Mormon position on abortion, which was formed in the early 70s, is somewhat more moderate and politically indifferent. I mean, it specifically says they don't have a stance politically on abortion. So that Mormons have been less involved on that issue politically than Catholics and evangelicals have been. But, I mean, certainly there's plenty of, pro-life sentiment within Mormonism, which makes them natural partners. Opposition to same-sex marriage is a really, that's one of the big hot topics right now, and they certainly see eye to eye on that one. I mentioned pornography as an issue they've rallied around. Issues of indecency and obscenity in media, a concern for more family-friendly kinds of media. To the degree that the evangelical right and the Mormon right are both sort of pro-free market capitalism, that becomes a natural affinity, which is part of the reason they tend to gravitate Republican rather than Democrat. Certain shared values about, individuality and personal responsibility, an antipathy toward big government, which in the Mormon case you can kind of trace back possibly to some of the bad experiences Mormons had with the federal government. That may be one genealogy for that kind of sentiment. No, it's not just disliking Obama.
And big support for the Iraq War. I think evangelicals and Mormons probably supported more than any of the groups.
I think that's probably safe to say. Yeah, there was certainly a lot of support for the war initiatives. So yeah, I mean, there are lots of issues, and those are just kind of like the culture wars. I mean, we could also start talking about less political concerns about wanting to move our communities, and you know, there are all kinds of ways in which they can start to work together.
I don't think I got anything on that list. It's a great list.
Those are usually the best.
You bet.
Yeah. This is a comment about a comment.
Wait, come on,
Because I fear the loss of the 9th and 10th Amendments, and I see Orrin Hatch and a lot of other congressmen doing that. That's what really, I loathe our Congress way more than I loathe vice president. So.
Thank you.
All right.
Same topic, people.
Okay. In your comments, Don Charles, you brought out very clearly that that there's a militant evangelical core, but that many evangelicals don't necessarily buy into what they're saying. Bridget, in your comments, you cited a survey that said, you know, more evangelicals would be willing to vote for a Mormon president than
more Republicans,
than Democrats. So I guess my question is, I'd appreciate if you would comment then on the role that third parties such as the media might play in inflating the controversy by giving a disproportionate voice to the militant evangelicals, which creates the sense that they are the face of Christianity in America and therefore the arbiters of what is and is not a Christian.
Okay, full disclosure, that was my father. And I'm almost wondering if that question was a setup, because this is actually one of my current passions. But I don't know if you know that. No, this is one of my big beefs, actually, about the way the media handled Romney's evangelical problem. The media just missed the boat. I mean, the media itself had this narrative which said that, you know, once they heard the militant minority, the Robert Jefferson saying Christians should only vote for Christians, never for a Mormon, they made that the face of evangelicalism. And I think there are various reasons for that. It's controversial. The media needs controversy. That's sort of part of how our media culture thrives. I think it also fits the way maybe liberal journalists like to perceive evangelicals. They're bigots. They're anti-pluralists. And once that narrative was in place, I mean, you couldn't shake it. Even though, I would argue, after Romney gave his faith speech in December 2007, he neutralized the boundary maintenance issues. But I think he neutralized them even more than he and his own staff realized. Going to 2012, the media still thought that evangelicals weren't voting for Romney because he was a Mormon. And there were increasing poll data to show that that wasn't the case. That in early 2012, the reason evangelicals liked Santorum more than Romney had nothing to do with his religion. Well, I should say nothing, but that wasn't the primary factor. The primary factor for them was they weren't sure Romney was enough of a social conservative for their taste. But the media did not see that. The media totally misunderstood what was happening. And you also raise the question of to what extent does the media make evangelicals the arbiters of what is Christian in general, right? I mean, why aren't you in Catholic voices weighing in on that question, for example? And I think that's also, yeah, that's a really insightful observation. I think that is kind of intriguing. That I think it has to do partly with the way that evangelicals are the most assertive about that. You know, they are the most emphatic about wanting to claim what is Christian. I mean, certainly other denominations have issued statements saying we don't think Mormons are Christians. Catholics did it, Methodists did it, Presbyterians did it. But the evangelicals are the most emphatic. I think that's one factor. But I think there's also something to be said for the way that the media make evangelicals the face of Christianity. They're big, they're visible. I think a lot of journalists are afraid of them. And I think that gives them an inflated presence on the cultural landscape.
I just have to add something to that really quick. I definitely have felt like the media was giving a disproportionate time to that vocal minority that was so against electing a Mormon president. There was this one woman named Trisha Erickson that I think CNN put her on. It might have been a different group, but I think it was CNN. And she made a lot of volatile comments about voting for Mormons. She's written this self-published book, which you can buy on Amazon.com for $3. This is sort of the cheesy cover called Can Mitt Romney Serve Two Masters? And, you know, they looked her up and they put her on to talk about, you know, evangelicals not voting for a Mormon. And she's nobody in the evangelical movement. She's nobody. She's never done anything with Mormon studies. There was no reason to put her on other than to generate controversy, which I realize that's kind of what the media needs to do to bring in the viewers. But I definitely have felt, as I've watched these campaigns, I've kind of just rolled my eyes again and again at this narrative that's being pushed of evangelicals not wanting to vote for Mormons. There's definitely that minority that is like that. But like I said, I have plenty of Democrat and more liberal agnostic atheist friends who have also said that they wouldn't vote for Mormon because they're concerned about the temple covenants and how a person can have both a commitment to the presidency of the United States and a commitment, make the temple covenants and commit to the LDS church. So it's not just evangelicals, which is, I tried to make that point in my response. It's not just evangelicals that are concerned about voting for a Mormon. I'd vote for one. I like John Huntsman a little better than Romney, but I'll vote for Romney.
Let me add one more thing here, though, which is kind of pulling out the other direction, because, okay, so I just kind of, you know, had my heyday with the media. I need to say, though, I think Mormons themselves were complicit in helping to promote this idea that evangelicals don't vote for Romney because they don't like us. Because that feeds into a certain Mormon sense of we're persecuting people, see, yeah, a martyrdom complex is a really good name for it. And so I think Mormons themselves have a burden of responsibility to bear in helping to promote that perception. Because it kind of feeds into a Mormon story that Mormons like to tell about themselves.
Mormon voices dropping into the speaker. Mormon voices put Trisha's comment in. If you haven't heard of Mormon voices, I think they're run by the same people who run FAIR, but they respond to Mormons being mentioned in the media, and they put Trisha Erickson's comments in the top 10 most anti-Mormon comments of 2011, which of course just brings more publicity to this nutter that nobody would be listening to if people weren't giving her the time of day. So, yeah, I just... that's all I wanted to add.
I was thinking
that
was the last word.
These are kind of peripheral and I think easy questions. They'll just help me because I don't feel like I have the background. One thing is, I think some of us here have a little trouble because we don't identify with the socially conservative part of Mormonism, and so we're not big on, you know, collaboration with the evangelicals. It doesn't support our personal political views. So it brought up the question in my own mind, because I don't know much, I guess, about evangelicals. You know, it brought up my ignorance. Are they more monolithic in their socially conservatism than Mormons are, or is it similar? You know, is there a fringe? Is the Mormon fringe that's more liberal, bigger as a percentage than?
Do you want to ask me that next question? You want me to answer?
And then I was asking. Maybe a question I had is. You know, it was interesting, John Charles, to hear you talk about, you know, that for at least conservative evangelicals, and maybe that's the most, but that interfaith for them is a four-letter word. And I wondered, can you speak in Mormonism? I know this isn't really the topic today, but to what degree that's true among Mormons that we might be uncomfortable with an ecumenical movement?
Go ahead. Those are great questions, and unfortunately, the tape might get cut off.
Okay, I'm going to just go really fast. One, I think that it's a spectrum in both religions, maybe more so in evangelicalism, at least in my experience. You'll find people all over the map if you actually look hard enough on issues like, we do tend to be Republican, I'm not denying that. My denomination is actually kind of on the progressive edge of the evangelical wing, so we've actually got a lot of Obama people in my denomination. We get along fine. My youth pastor at my church has an Obama sticker on his guitar case. I haven't ripped it off yet. but there's a spectrum. You'll definitely find people who are all over the place on like birth control and gay marriage. My advisor's a Democrat, and I go to what I think is a pretty conservative evangelical college, so there's definitely a spectrum on these social issues. Although we do tend to be towards the conservative end of the spectrum. Anyways, and what was two again?
Whether Mormons have as much of a problem with interfaith.
Oh, Mormons like other religions very much. This was discussed in American Grace. Mormons had very high... Mormons like everybody else, and they immensely like themselves, but nobody likes them. That is basically...
really getting together and do it?
They try. I know that my local wards have hosted several like Jewish Mormon interfaith things. So I see Mormons trying to engage in interfaith stuff often enough.
I feel like it's services. Like I have Colorado Springs, like big focus on the family, and mm-hmm. I feel like, man, we're into service projects. The Mormons are. We could do so much service projects.
Maybe it varies
with other with New Life to the huge churches, but it doesn't happen. I mean, it'd be perfect. We talk big, you know. We talk the talk, but I'm not sure we're walking the walk.
Well, the mic's probably off. The tape's probably off, so unfortunately we'll have to like wrap this up. But I would just say what happens in Mormonism is the church as an institution has no interest in things like interfaith dialogue. But there's lots of interest in interfaith community endeavors. And the church constantly urges members to do those things. On the other hand, Mormonism does have a tradition of being kind of insular, and so that message may not be getting out as much as church leaders would like. But certainly since the 90s, church leaders have been quite insistent they would like to see Mormons doing interfaith kinds of activities at the community level.
All right. Great comments, everyone.